The past 2 weeks we talked about the sufferings of Christ, the crosses we bear. I think one certainly that we have to bear in mind is our identity as Catholics in a secular world. Through a number of discussions with Dr. Royal, I thought this was a very fitting title for his presentation. To give you a little bit of background of Dr. Royal, he is president of the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C., and he is a very prolific author. He has currently written a book, The God That Does Not Fail. He has a number of other ones. I'll highlight just a couple, The Catholic Martyrs of the 20th Century, Comprehensive Global History. He also wrote one with George Weigel, Building a Free Society. He has written a number of articles for Crisis Magazine, First Things, The Washington Post, The Washington Times, The National Review, Wall Street Journal, and The American Spectator. Dr. Royal is a Fulbright scholar. He earned his bachelor's and master's degree from Brown University and a PhD from Catholic University in America. I've had a few conversations with him. He's just a wonderful man. I can't wait to hear him talk. So if you please give him a warm introduction. Thank you very much. I have, by the way, a few copies of that article that Father Eric was talking about, so I'll have them over by the table.
Well, I don't know that I've ever been in a room where the speaker can't get to the podium. But I'm very happy to be here with you. I love this parish. This parish reminds me very much of the parish I grew up in. In Connecticut, and it's good to see this kind of liveliness in a city like Indianapolis. This type of liveliness, don't take it for granted. When you talk about being Catholic in the secular age, this is the sort of thing that holds together the kind of identity for Catholics in a society like ours that otherwise will simply get swept away. And we know how dynamic American society can tend to be, you know, the tremendous media pressures that are on us and whatnot. And as modest in some ways as putting spaghetti and some salad out on table might be and getting together during Lent, it's absolutely crucially important. And that's why when Bruce and I began to talk, I knew I ought to come out here. I like going to parishes, to individual parishes to begin with. It's very hard for me to fit them into my schedule, and it so worked out I was on the way to Dallas. So this was a good fit. And plus, I'd never heard of spaghetti and theology. How can you say no to spaghetti and theology? I'm going to ask your indulgence. I'm just getting over this flu that's all over the... I don't know if it's here in the Midwest, but it's on both coasts. And so my voice may be a little bad. If you can't hear me, just yell out. I'll be happy to try to repeat. I also left my reading glasses at home, so I bought these at Dulles Airport. So my reading may be a little rocky here, but just indulge going on a bit. Now, the topic that I wanted to talk about with you, one that I've been actually thinking about quite a bit lately, is where Catholics stand in the United States in the year 2008. I just gave the first St. Thomas More lecture at Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. And my topic was the present position of Catholics in America. Some of you may recall that there's a book by the great Cardinal Newman called The Present Position of Catholics in England, and he tries to parse out where it is that Catholics actually stand in a country that was long anti-Catholic. America, too, has had an unfortunate history of anti-Catholicism, which largely has been superseded. And as we all know, I mean, it's very... You do run up against anti-Catholicism in different parts of the country, sometimes in your own neighborhood. But as we all know, Catholics have done very well in the United States. Depending on how you put the figures together, it can come out in different ways. But it's probably, maybe arguable, that Catholics as a group have even surpassed Jews in terms of per capita earning power. That's how much Catholics have succeeded in this country. We owe this country a great deal. The Catholic Church in this country has done great things for the Church in Rome and the Church back in Europe. So our identity as Catholics here in America is something to be proud of. We should be proud both of the American side of that identity and of the Catholic side of that identity. But what I'd like to talk to you about tonight is that this success, as much as we have to welcome it, also has with it some dangers, and it also has some opportunities. I'm going to talk about those, and then I want to talk about some concrete things that you can do to try to reinforce a Catholic, a vibrant, a dynamic, a creative Catholic identity that's also an American identity. So, let me start out with a story. This is a story a priest told me just after he'd come back from Rome, being a seminarian in Rome. He'd just been ordained a priest. And he went to a parish in my home diocese, in my home diocese, which is the Diocese of Bridgeport, Connecticut. My current diocese is the same as Father Anderton's Arlington, Virginia, which is a wonderful diocese, by the way. But this young priest came back, and he was assigned to his first assignment, and there are two ends of Fairfield County in the Bridgeport Diocese. The part that I grew up on was the wrong side of the tracks, and the other side is the Gold Coast going down toward New York, and he was in one of these, you know, very wealthy parishes, which, by the way, looks like a congregational church. It's white. It doesn't look like this church. It looks very much like a congregational church, and already it begins to tell you that somehow the assimilation on the economic and the social side and whatnot has had some effect even on the way that Catholic churches can look in this country. And the head of the women's group calls him up and says, "Oh, Father so-and-so, we're so happy to have a bright young priest here from Rome. We'd love to have you as a chaplain in our women's group." He says, "Oh, I'd love that." "Well, what do you do?" "Well, we have Mass on Wednesday mornings, and then we have usually we have a reflection which priest provides." "Well, that's great." And on the surface, it sounds very much like this, a way of building Catholic identity, women who, you know, want to know more about the faith, etc. Then she says, "Okay, that's wonderful, but just one last thing. Is it okay if so-and-so bakes the bread for the Eucharist?" And he says, "Oh yeah, fine." He said, "Just make sure you use one of the approved recipes." And she says, "Approved recipes?" I forget what he actually told me about this, but it goes something like this. "Marianne usually bakes her banana nut bread." And this wasn't that long ago. This was about 10, 12 years ago. And they start to fight naturally because, you know, she's thinking, "Oh, look, you know, we're women, we're trying to do this," and this. And he gets an inspiration. He stops arguing with her. He gets an inspiration, and he says, "You don't know, do you?" She says, "What?" Now, you know, this is a very affluent, very highly educated parish, obviously not highly educated in Catholicism, but highly educated. And she says, "I don't know what." He says, "You don't know why it is we use unleavened bread in the Eucharist, do you?" She says, "No." "It's because," he says, "the Jews at Passover always use unleavened bread, and our Lord's Last Supper was a Passover meal. And therefore, we are going to use the same thing that our Lord used." And she said to him, "Well, okay, if it's a Jewish thing, then it's all right." Now, I heard this from the priest himself in this sentence. Now, you know, this sort of thing happens all the time. And this was not a woman, you know, who was against the church. She was with the church, but had no sense of the history of why we do many different things, especially right around the Eucharist, which is one of the most central, I would argue, the central element of our sacramental life. And I think in that one story, I mean, I tell it because it's funny, but I think I tell it also because I think in that one story, you begin to see the difficulty where Catholics are assimilated too much to a surrounding culture without recognizing that our culture is not a Catholic culture. Now, does that mean that we can have no engagement with the outside culture? Absolutely not. In fact, this is something I hope all of you will walk out of here with in your minds.
The Catholic Church is not like a little Bible sect. The sociologists of religion actually have these categories of church and sect, and the Catholic Church is the church, and the Protestant churches tend to be these little sects. The little sects like to, you know, be off by themselves, purity, be away from the public realm, not engage culture, not get too involved in culture at all. The Catholic Church has always been a church since it really began to grow, that believes that it has a mission, as our Lord says at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, to preach the gospel to the whole world. And not only preach the gospel, because obviously there are going to be people around us who are not receptive to the gospel message, and with whom we have to live in Christian charity. So one of the main things that a Catholic has to learn how to do in a pluralist society like ours is to be able to agree with people and to compromise on certain things. And that's, you know, generally it has worked pretty well throughout American history. Once we got over the sometimes quite violent anti-Catholicism that existed in the United States, we actually found a modus vivendi, and for a long time, if truth be told, Catholics were rather more influential than just about any other body in America. Now, I want to think through with you a little bit this notion of a secular age, because it relates to what I've just been saying. Because there are two terms that you'll hear people using in debates these days, particularly people who want to exclude the church from having a say about anything in public. You know, usually it's over abortion or gay marriage or, you know, whatever it's going to be. By the way, I've taken a page out of the book of this young priest that I was just talking about. Whenever somebody tells me that I can't use my Catholic faith to oppose gay marriage, which, by the way, I don't think is really what's going on. I think this is a natural law argument. I usually tell them, no, it's not a bunch of Italians over in Rome who have too much time on their hands who have invented this this idea that homosexuality is wrong. We're just defending Moses, you know? It's a Jewish thing. We're remaining faithful to something that goes back beyond our own tradition. But look, think about this for a minute. Ours is the one faith. Christianity is the one faith in the world that really does draw a distinction between church and state, and did right from the beginning. When our Lord said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God, he wasn't just saying that because he was, you know, trying to deal with a situation and hoped it would keep him out of trouble. It obviously didn't in the long run. There's been an understanding in Christianity that actually took on institutional forms, because in the ancient world, and even in Judaism, the religious dimension and the political dimension were one thing, as they are in Islam today, which is why the dialogue with Islam is so difficult. Islamists, many of them at least, follow a certain, the jihadists in general, tend to follow a certain tradition, that they need their caliph. They need a secular ruler who is also the head of the religious structure. And when the Ottoman Turks collapsed in 1918, they regard that as sort of the, you know, the disappearance of the caliphate, and they feel, you know, they don't know where to go. I've actually been in Turkey and talked with people about this separation of church and state, and they said, boy, that's in the gospel. And didn't know. You think people know about this stuff. In fact, they don't. But I want to point to a different element in this. Because if it's true, as I believe it's undoubtedly true in the Catholic tradition, that there needs to be a church that is separate from all temporal power, because it has to be able to criticize all temporal power. And naturally, churches work with governments and with, you know, with social groups and help out in soup kitchens and relief work and all sorts of other things. But the church has to be the church. If the church does not be itself, is not itself, it has nothing to offer to the rest of the world. And so there's got to be a distance. And the right way to think about who we are in dialogue with is not necessarily something that is anti-Catholic. I want to make that clear. That a secular, there always is an element of secularity in every age. And we happen to be in an age which is particularly secular, but I don't necessarily see that as an evil. It offers a lot of opportunities. It offers opportunities for us to speak in public if it's done together, if it's done right. What we do have to draw an absolute line against is not the properly secular, but secularism. Secularism is not neutral. I live in Washington, and I hear these arguments all the time that, you know, our system is a system of secularism, and therefore, you know, we can't have these religious voices talking about this and that in public. Well, why not? It's a democracy. I mean, are only people who are not religious supposed to be able to talk in public? You know, if somebody tells you that you have religious freedom because you can gather together like this in a church or you can go pray in your house, I say, whoop-de-doo. Even the Soviets said that they had that. You know, the Catholic Church engages all elements of society, and I would say any other religious group that believes it has the right to speak out in public ought to be able to do so, and that was certainly the understanding in these United States for much of our history. But secularism is something quite different than that secular space where all voices, religious and non-religious, are welcome. Secularism is not neutral. It is a substantive position like Methodism or Marxism or Catholicism. So if we are being told about the public realm that we cannot speak out in public about these issues because these are just positions we hold by faith, I say, so what? You know, even if they are, I don't think that the church does not try to impose in American society belief in the Trinity or belief in the real presence, but it does put extra energy behind what are simply natural law principles like protecting innocent human life in the womb, or helping poor people, or making sure that at the end of life, people who are infirm, or they're not forced into assisted suicide or euthanasia, which is, you know, it's coming. I'm of the generation, I think, that's going to see a lot of social pressure towards that end. But the church is fulfilling its own proper role toward a proper secular order when it opposes these things there. And it has a right to say that secularism should not, because it is not a fair system in a democracy. Now, some of you may not believe what I'm about to say, but I wrote an article about this, if any of you want to see it, on the First Things website. Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France being the country that has, in the Western world, most tried to separate church and state, religion and politics, you know, religious reflection, and even just human life. Nicolas Sarkozy was made a canon of St. John Lateran back in December. And he went there and gave what I think is the most amazing modern speech by a Western head of state, in which he said that the French, who have this idea of secularism, which they call laïcité, have been wrong to try to push out Catholicism and other voices from the public square. He says it's unfair. You know, it would be more liberal, more true to our own history, more true to our own traditions, to welcome all the wisdom of all the religious traditions of our people. Because the conditions of modernity, he said, some people think that religion is not important in modernity because we have great prosperity and we have technology and whatnot. He says, oh no, it's precisely the opposite. But that because of the way that these sort of impersonal forces in the modern world are so dominant, we need even more of the kind of faith, of the kind of hope, and of the kind of charity that the religious tradition can bring. Now, when I saw this, naturally, and I wrote an article about it, but you can imagine if even in France, this sort of argument is starting to be made. People have begun to understand something dangerous about what happens when you have a strictly secularist, not secular, secularist society in which religious voices cannot speak. So, be forearmed with this. When you're talking with people and they tell you you can't come forward with religious arguments, I say, why not? You know, but religious arguments, non-religious arguments are made all the time, and this is just a matter of fairness. Now, you may have noticed that some of the new militant atheists, as I like to call them, this is the Richard Dawkinses and the Daniel Dennetts and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens. This is a group of really violent anti-religious writers have come along largely since 9/11 and begun to blame religion for all the violence in the world. Richard Dawkins actually says religion is not exactly the root of all evil, but it comes pretty close. And he's even talked about religion as child abuse. that bringing up children in a religious faith is child abuse. Now, I don't think these guys have done themselves a whole lot of good. They've been trying to capitalize on what happened on 9/11. They point to the unfortunate way that certain currents in Islam have gotten violent, and they say, oh, that's basically what religion is. On his face, historically, of course, it's absurd. If you look back at Francis of Assisi and Benedict and Ignatius of Loyola, and this is just in the Catholic tradition, there obviously are many, many different currents in religiosity other than these violent ones. But their very attack, I think, has drawn forth some very interesting reactions, because it's clear you don't attack something that is weak. I told Cardinal George of Chicago this once, and he said, sure, I hope you're right about this, Bob. One of the reasons why the secularists are so irritated at the moment and are coming forth with these attacks on all religion is that religion remains powerful in the world. So not only, I mean, if you get involved in a debate and someone says, you know, you're using a religious argument, most other people are as well. You know, there's an old theory in sociology, it's called secularization theory. What was supposed to happen in the modern world was that after education and science and technology spread and so-called enlightenment was going to spread, that religion was supposed to disappear. Now, people would realize this was kind of a pre-modern superstition, and you know, science now is really explaining the world to us. In fact, what is happening around the world, and not just in the Muslim world, is a re-energizing of religion. There's a huge growth, you hardly read about this because the press doesn't report on it, there's a huge growth of evangelicals and Pentecostals, not only in this country, but in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, and around the world. And it's precisely because of these challenges, as Sarkozy was talking about, that modernity brings into our lives, that people realize that religiosity is an identity that helps stabilize them, help stabilize their families, help stabilize their communities, and brings many, many positive values and not simply violence into the world. Now, other than Western Europe, and even in Western Europe, only parts of Western Europe secularized during the 20th century, this secularization theory has not worked out. And in fact, quite the opposite is taking place. My friend Peter Berger, who's a brilliant sociologist of religion at Boston University, calls this the desecularization of the world, because what was supposed to happen not only didn't happen, but it's going in the other direction. The religiosity is becoming actually stronger. Now, it's very important that we all be in dialogue with one another and make sure that those passions, those moral commitments that we make don't turn violent, that they become modes of conversation with one another. But pretty much, you know, that's what's happened in the world. I'm involved in Washington, and naturally in Washington people tend to arrive who are interested in dialogue, but I'm in dialogue with evangelicals, Jews, Muslims, you know, Sikhs, all sorts of people who realize that we all have a common interest in making sure that the right kind of religious connections are developed. Now, there's also another element of the identity question that I want to raise with you. A difficulty for Catholics and these other believers who are coming forth in public right now is this. And I always talk about this whenever I talk to a foreign audience about religiosity. If you were to judge American culture, just think about this, because most foreigners do judge American culture by American movies, American television, and American rock and roll. You'd never have, you would never know that a group like this ever met in the basement of a church in Indianapolis on a Wednesday. On a Wednesday night. And we have to understand the great threat that the media, the Hollywood, I don't want to overstate this, you know, I'm not trying to be anti-Hollywood, anti-media, and also the academy, colleges and universities play into this as well. We can underestimate the danger that these three particular areas of our culture present. And if you want to get a sense of perhaps why there's this, you know, this odd representation of who we are and what religion is like, I mean, if you've noticed, religion doesn't exactly get the best press when there are movies about religiosity, and then occasionally something good happens, but it's almost universally negative. But if you look at these three sectors, Let me give you just some quick statistics. Roughly 90% of Americans are religious believers of some kind. And they usually point out that they are attached to some particular denomination. The denomination is perhaps not the right word because it kind of it means that everybody is sort of on an equal plane. A Catholic should not really think that the Catholic Church is a denomination alongside of others. Catholic Church is the one true church, and you must believe that. But let's, for the sake of argument, faith groups, denominations in the United States, 90% of Americans regard themselves as members of a church, a synagogue, temple, whatever they belong to. Only 10% really are non-believers. Similar surveys have been done of the media, Hollywood. It applies to a certain extent to colleges and universities. And it's the exact mirror image. About 10% of people in the prestige media, 10% of people in Hollywood, that seems a little high to me, actually. But 10% of the people in elite universities are seriously religious. So it's not a surprise that these segments of the society that even tell us about who we are give us an impression of our society that's very far from the reality. And you can't underestimate in your life. You can't underestimate in what you allow your children to look at on TV. You can't underestimate in, when you're looking at news stories, et cetera, the distorting factor. And it's not a matter of conscious bias. It's a matter of people who are living in a milieu where they don't even come in contact with religious people. I'll give you two examples that are, in my hometown parish paper, which is the Washington Post. About 10 or 15 years ago, there was a big protest over the fact that the Post never covers the pro-life march in Washington, which, if you've ever been to it, is one of the most glorious American events you'll ever see. 50,000, 100,000 people show up, depending on the year. They're not there for anything. They're not asking for anything for themselves. All they want us to do is to stop murdering babies in the womb. And they, very respectfully and joyfully singing, march down Constitution Avenue, go visit, go lobby. And about 10 or 15 years ago, there was a big controversy in Washington, because the Washington Post, which always puts, pro-abort demonstrations on the front page, has usually a little story in the Metro section about the pro-life march, as if, it's sort of a bunch of kooks getting. And so finally, even they felt bad in conscience about this. And some of the editors were interviewed, and they said, well, I guess it's because we just don't know anybody who goes to these sorts of things. Who your friends are, obviously, you're shaped by who your friends are, and you pick friends who are like you. And they are in a cocoon under these sorts of matters. Now, the Post is reliable on reporting on what NASA did the other day and maybe about what happened in Iraq. But on this sort of issue, you have to be very, very skeptical. And I'll tell you a story, another very controversial case, when the religious right, the sort of the evangelicals, were coming back into American public life. And the evangelicals were kind of a set. They stayed out of public life for a long time. But it was abortion, it was school prayer, it was conversations with Catholics that we started to get involved in. And they, by the way, love natural law theory. Catholics don't talk about natural law theory very much, but every time I go to a conference and somebody starts talking about natural law theory, I know it's an evangelical, because Catholics are too embarrassed to talk about natural law theory these days. But the Washington Post was kind of miffed that the evangelicals, who are these people coming out and talking about, morals and society and whatnot? And on the front page, a reporter said that this group of evangelicals, who are composed of people who are poor, relatively poor, uneducated, and easily led, blah, blah, blah. Well, the National Association of Evangelicals, which is led by a very sophisticated guy with a PhD, put out a fact sheet the next day showing, which is quite true, and if you think about it for a second, you would know it's true, because stable people in evangelical churches obviously stay away from drugs, they value family, they value education, so they are actually more educated than the average American. They're actually wealthier than the average American. And, as far as being easily led, well, who knows about that? This is a great embarrassment that one of the great newspapers of the United States had on its front page, something that a had it been done about any other group, you know, just simply the simplest investigation, the simplest looking into the figures would have revealed this to be the bias that it was. So I, you know, I encourage you to be very cautious, because we all, you know, we're all influenced by this stuff, and we're influenced by it in ways that we can't even always track down, because it's so much around us, and there's so much of a portrayal that, you know, the Catholic Church is pedophilia, the Catholic Church is, you know, one thing or another. It's the Pope is sort of an authoritarian. We know what Catholic communities are like. We know that they're varied, that people have all sorts of gifts within Catholic communities, that like any other group, we have our bad apples. But we have to be able to distinguish what people are telling us we are from what we are, actually are. And we've got to build up our identity to a much stronger degree than I think has been the case in the past. Now, I grew up in a, as I said, in a parish very much like this one that had a very thick, the sociologists of Catholicism call this ghetto Catholicism. It had a very thick set of social institutions. I mean, there were women's sodalities and, you know, men's clubs and, you know, all sorts of different things. I hope you have that in this parish, because it's really one of the great, it's a very American thing, but it's also a great Catholic thing. I mean, we have these different kinds of institutions that make us into special communities. And it's important to keep those alive. Don't let them die. You know, they have to be adapted. We have to constantly, since we engage the secular world, we have to constantly adapt those things to do a better job and to, you know, to deliver the kinds of services that people need. There's no end to this. There's no minimizing the importance of this, and there's no telling how much this, the getting together like this and talking about such issues pushes back that public, that mistaken public view of the Catholic Church, of Christianity in general, of religiosity in general. We have to open a space to be able to do that. I've been saying lately that we really got to get bold about talking about issues that may seem touchy. Because we all have, you know, we have family members, we ourselves, you know, are weak, we've fallen, things happen. But as a culture, we have got to start to look at the terrible consequences of some departures from Christian teaching over the last 20 or 30 years. And I'm going to stick with some of these pro-life issues because I think they're easy to understand. There are other consequences of this, of course. And there are consequences that people don't believe in truth any longer, and they kind of think, you know, whatever you believe is true is sort of okay. But let me give you one example in which kind of reducing truth claims to individuals and allowing people to make up their own morality, I think, has been an utter disaster for this country. And naturally, it has to do with sex. I gave this talk a while ago, and a priest came up to me and said, you know, a lot of people say that Catholics are obsessed with sex. And I said to him, you know, I turn the TV on, and I always say, looks to me like the TV is obsessed with sex, and I'd like to stop it from being obsessed with sex. And there's a good reason for this. It's not simply that Catholics are Puritans. We're not Puritans. I mean, we had kind of quarrels with Puritans, as a matter of fact. The good reasons for this are that what we've done by removing virtually all restrictions on sexuality is an utter disaster in a variety of ways. Now, let me just give you a comparison. People talk about the crimes of organized religion. This is what the anti-religious people generally do, right? Crusades, inquisitions, wars of religion, you know, all this sort of thing. And admittedly, these are problems, although I'm not so sure the Crusades were a problem when Europe was being attacked by Islam. You know, these are problems to use religious principles, politicians using religious principles to impose themselves on other people. But in the 20th century, we saw the consequences of what I call organized irreligion. We saw it in communism, which was the most atheistic, you know, rationalist attempt to set up a society absent God. And communism killed 100 million people in the 20th century. If you want to read about some of this, it's in my book, The Catholic Martyrs of the 20th Century. It's shocking. I had no idea about some of these cases until I systematically started to go through and look at the martyrs, the religious martyrs in the 20th century. But 100 million under Nazism, under communism. Under Nazism, which was scientific racism. Now, some people just sort of think that Nazis were crazy. They had a scientific, rational view that was racist, that they thought was supported by science, that they were not about to let the church stop them from pursuing, and they killed 40 million people, not quite as many as communism, but between them 140 million people died in the 20th century as a result of organized irreligion. But we should not take for granted in our Western democracies that we've entirely escaped those sorts of slaughters of the innocents. We know that in this country, since abortion has been legalized, 50 million babies have died in the womb. In other words, Roe v. Wade has killed more children in the womb than Nazism killed in the 20th century. Right? And if you look at around the world, how other countries which have implemented pro-abortion laws have the large numbers of people that have been killed as a result of this, I think it's arguable that abortion has killed more than communism and Nazism, which we think are the great scourges, the great aberrations of the 20th century, which also had many good things that happened in it. You know, medicine developed, and education, and prosperity began to spread around the world. But just think of that. You know, that's one of the consequences of the sexual revolution. Another one that people used to talk about in the 80s, when I first got to Washington, I've been in Washington 25 years, and I'm starting to feel like I've paid my debt to society now, and maybe it's time for me to be put on release for good behavior. The other thing that people don't talk about is what the sexual revolution did to the family. You know, because we accepted a wrong notion that truth is whatever somebody says it is, and, you know, we can't legislate morality. Well, if you think about it, almost every law on the books is legislating morality. This is the one area that we're told we can't legislate morality. Let me just give you a snapshot. Most societies prior to the 1960s, when a lot of this stuff got going, would typically have an illegitimacy rate of about 5 or 6%. You know, people are weak, you know, you fall in love with somebody, things happen. It's 5 or 6%. Sometimes it goes up a little, and it kind of went up a little in England at the end of the 18th century, and then England became Victorian. You know, they got a little bit more straight-laced and came right back down to where it was. And that was true for the United States for much of its history. Today, and I'm just giving you round figures, I didn't bother looking, you know, exactly where we are right now, but roughly this is what the rate of children born out of wedlock is in the United States. And when I say this, I'm not trying to stigmatize anyone. I mean, you know, we're all sinners, and all Catholics should try to help out these situations as much as possible. But it is not a good thing for the children who are born into a single-parent family or even a more chaotic situation. We know that the rates of alcoholism, drug use, promiscuity, you know, crime, etc., are much higher in those families that really kind of fail to form, you know, than in the rest of society. So this is a public issue. This isn't just an inner Catholic question. Whites in the United States have a 25%, roughly 25% rate of births out of wedlock. That's, if you take that 6%, 5, 6% figure, that's 4 to 5 times what historically, before contraception was even known, historically what the rate used to be. And as always happens, the consequences of bad ideas are far worse on people who are in worse socioeconomic circumstances. So blacks in the United States have an 80% rate of birth outside of marriage. Now you think about that. That means whole communities exist in which almost no one has both a mother and a father. And in the country as a whole, 1/3 of the children born these days, roughly, are not born within wedlock. Now, this situation has not been helped by the way that celebrities, tend to kind of glorify having children outside of wedlock. This is something, it seems to me, that we Catholics and others concerned about the health of the country, about the children who are being produced in this way, have to speak about. And I think if it's talked about in the right way, not talked about, scolding and you know, pointing fingers, but talked about simply in realistic terms. This is what Catholics are able to do in public. You don't have to point to your Catholicism. I mean, everybody knows that Catholics think that adultery and fornication are wrong. From Jesus says this. It's not something we made up. But we have to point to that and say, look, this has real human consequences, and that's why, from time immemorial, it was always thought to be a very bad idea. So I would... I take this just as one example, and I don't want to go on too long tonight with you. Bruce, how long have I got? Where's Bruce? I guess he's going off somewhere. Okay. I was struck by Father's homily today about, role models, because I've been thinking about this a lot myself lately. Why is it that we get so upset when the Roger Clemenses and the Andy Pettits and the Sammy Sosas and the Barry Bonds and the Mark Maguires turn out to be taking steroids and using drugs to succeed? And, in one way, it doesn't really matter all that much. It's only baseball. Phone attack. It's only baseball. It's baseball. I mean, it's not the end of the world. But we all know that... I grew up playing football in Connecticut, and I can remember I thought that Bart Starr at the Green Bay Packers, which was kind of cool competence he had, was just the greatest thing. But I also wanted to be a little bit like Joe Willie Namath when he really needed that kind of crazy stuff that he was able to do too. And that's the way we are. I mean, we imitate other people. And we know that if we present very prominent, accomplished people who are doing these sorts of things, it ill serves the society. And that's why I'm actually at the point where not only don't I ever want to hear about Britney Spears again, I think it would be a great boon to Western civilization if we had a moratorium on Britney reports for a while. But I want to point in a different direction, because in our tradition there's something called conformity to Christ. And here I'm just going to talk for a few minutes and then end up, and maybe we can have some questions and some comments. Conformity isn't something that in the Western world is not in high esteem right now. I mean, who wants to be called a conformist, wants to conform his life to somebody else? But in fact, we do it all the time. I was watching American Idol with my daughter last night. I have to do this as a father. And actually, it was very good this year. Some very good singers. And kids all around the country hear that, and they want to sing like that. They want to be, they want to imitate that stuff. And some of the kids who are competing, are told, well, you're imitating somebody else. Well, of course they are, because how do you begin to do something? You see a priest, and you want to be a priest. You see a doctor, and you want to be a doctor. You see a ball player, and you want to be a ball player. You see a mother, and you want to be a mother. Everybody is moved by persons. Cardinal Newman has a very beautiful passage about this, how voices move us and looks inflame us. And we're engaged with one another. We are much more influenced by people who we admire, and maybe also influenced by people we don't admire, than even by rational arguments. Because we see what full human consequences can be. If I do that, I could be that. That would be great. There used to be something in the tradition called conformity to Christ. And I think that one of the ways that Catholics can really strengthen identity is by digging into some of this material that we have in great abundance in our tradition. We've got a 2,000-year tradition that is utterly inexhaustible. I'm going to put in a brief commercial here. With my left hand, I run a program called the Catholic Distance University. It's an online distance program in which you can do continuing education, you can study to be a catechist, you can get a BA degree, you can get an MA in theology. CDU.edu is the website. I do this, most of my staff do the work, but I do this because Catholics have to reattach to the tradition again. We have an immense, elaborated tradition. Catholics are the ones who give the ideas to evangelicals and even Jews about how we operate in a public pluralism like the one that we have now. I can tell you this from personal experience in Washington. So anything you can do to reconnect yourself with that tradition, So you will know that you don't bake banana nut bread for the Eucharist, and many other things, of course. Will deepen who you are as a Catholic. It'll increase your roots, not only with other people who you're alive with right now, but with 2,000 years of Catholics who have gone before us, many of whom were very smart and very holy and very, very much capable of dealing with their own situations, which at times were even much more challenging than ours. People look back at the Middle Ages and they say, oh, what a great age of faith. Just absolutely wonderful. Well, it was a great age of faith because great saints like St. Francis of Assisi saw corruption, they saw worldliness, they saw the pursuit of greed, and St. Francis started a religious order. Similarly, St. Dominic Guzman in Spain saw the trouble with the Cathars, who despised the body, by the way. They believed that only the spirit mattered, which is not a Catholic position. Catholic position is a human being is a body and a soul, so that both the body and the soul need to be cared for and need to be thought about. So the great Dominicans, the great order of preachers, grew up and went around the countryside. And if you want to know why there was a great age of faith in the Middle Ages, it's because there was a challenge and Catholics rose to it. A similar thing happened at the Reformation with the great founding of the Jesuits by St. Ignatius of Loyola. And it's happened again and again and again. And it may very well be that it's a time when some of us in this room, people in lots of other rooms exactly like this one, need to step forward and to need to do something for the sake of Catholic identity and also for the sake of the United States of America, this country that we love so much. So let me just close with some suggestions for, during Lent, some things that you can do. You can sign up for a course on Benedict's book, Jesus of Nazareth, with Catholic Distance University. You can read that with one of our very fine professors, Brian Benestad. But I've learned over the years myself that one of the best things you can do is to read the Bible slowly in what's called a Lectio Divina. And the reason you should do reading like this and other spiritual reading is to take you away from the electronic media, especially during Lent. If you try to do a day without watching TV or listening to the radio or talking on your cell phone very much, you'll find out how attached to it you really are. You'll start getting pretty jittery, and it's not the coffee either. It's kind of withdrawal symptoms. But with Lectio Divina, you read very slowly in the Bible. New Testament is the best thing to read. And you just stop when something strikes you. Then you reflect on it. And then you read a bit more. Something else strikes you, and you stop and reflect on that. The priest who instructed me in this once said, only two things can happen when you do Lectio Divina, divine reading. Either you'll read a lot, because nothing strikes you, or you'll contemplate a lot. You'll stop at various points. But unless you start to do that, unless you start to let that stuff soak into you, you won't be familiar with this man, Jesus, that we're all supposed to be conformed to. Now, when we imitate Jesus, we're not going to be walking around in sandals and long white clothes and let our hair grow long. That was the mistake of the 60s. But I could get started on this one. I won't. It was my time in college. But do this for a while. And do it with the idea that I'm not just doing Bible reading. I'm here to kind of figure out, this human being was sent into the world, was sent into the secular dimension of reality, because God made that world and believed it was worth redeeming. It was so much worth redeeming that he was willing to die on a cross in a terrible way. So read that not like, I'm doing Bible study, but read it like, what is there here that should be talking to me as this person in these circumstances in Indianapolis, in America in 2008? And you'll be surprised. You'll be very surprised at the things that God starts to put in your head. Because when we start to listen, he tells us stuff. That's one of the other things that it took me a very long time to learn about prayer. And maybe some of you were not as dumb as I was about this. But, when I'm praying, I'm always kind of talking. And I find that when I stop talking is when my prayers are really the best. I try to listen more. And as I get older, I try to do this quite a bit more, because the older you get, the more you realize that you don't have as many answers as you thought you once had. And here, too, you're tuning into a different kind of World Wide Web, if I can put it that way. It's one that's going to stay with you forever and whose information is reliable. There are a whole bunch of great books. But, you know, the classic Imitation of Christ is one that I go back to myself year after year. You know, depending on the translation you can get, it can be a little bit stilted. But the Imitation of Christ, that very idea, the very notion that when we are living our lives, that is what we are about, is quite helpful. And if those aren't helpful to you, I think that I'm a great enthusiast of St. Jose Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei. I'm not a member of Opus Dei, but he has these little books, you know, of kind of spiritual insights. And at times in my life, I just think they're simple, but they're so simple that they just kind of blow everything away. You know, you just feel that you're just being energized. Francis de Sales' Introduction to the Devout Life, one of the most charming, gentle, wise of saints, Introduction to the Devout Life, a book that you can read over and over and over again. And then there's another more recent favorite of mine, a man with an Italian name who actually grew up in Germany, Romano Guardini, his book, The Lord. Just a fabulous reflection on our Lord. But pick up one of these volumes, or pick up a Bible. Or just pray. You know, it's good to just pray, but we've got this wonderful stuff in the tradition that reconnects us with our roots. You know, the Catholic Church basically absorbed everything that was good in classical culture and then survived, as a result of that, the rise and fall of several civilizations. So I think, you know, we know that this stuff is tested and it can help us a great deal. So give it a try and see where it takes you. I think you'll find that it's life-changing. You know, if you're of a more mystical bent, as John of the Cross, as Teresa of Avila, Father Benedict Rochelle is one of the great and funny men alive. Every time I see him, my spirit is lifted. And we need this stuff because we're so bombarded by the other things that are all around us. We really need this ballast to take us in a different place. I think you probably know. I mean, I feel this with my children. I feel it even with I have a granddaughter now. I feel it even with her that it's out of my control. So the only thing I can do is to try to find another approach to it. Well, let me just conclude on one note. You know, there's been a lot of talk about Vatican II. And what was done at Vatican II and what was not done. And you know, it introduced a lot of chaos into the church, and certainly under the papacy of John Paul II and now under the papacy of Benedict XVI, the church has kind of stabilized in a variety of ways. But one of the things that I think remains a powerful new element that came out of Vatican II is the need for the laity to be involved in the world. In the past, and we're still working this out, by the way, in Washington, in the past, it was bishops, you know, who largely presented the public face of the church. And the bishops, of course, still are the authoritative teachers, the authoritative successors to the apostles in every diocese. Every bishop in his diocese is sovereign in that diocese. But lay people have a special vocation in the modern world because of this particular moment that we're in. This secular age that we're in. There's going to be a realm of the secular and of pluralism for the foreseeable future, and perhaps forever. Maybe that's the best organization of human societies, and maybe that's what God has called us to. And that means that while the church goes out and seeks to evangelize in the full sense of the term, which means to turn people into believing, practicing Catholics, the specific role of the laity is to take Catholic principles and to see that they permeate these free societies. And to do that, I think you all know, is hard. It means, you know, being very quick on your feet and knowing how to argue and when to argue and when not to argue. It means knowing what you're talking about. It means being courageous. One of the hardest things for most people is to say some hard things when it can have, you know, it can have social consequences for you, maybe even professional consequences. But that's the role that laity are now called upon to perform in our society. Because if we don't do it, for all the efforts that the bishops will make, we will not really be a leaven. There will not be that, even if it's an indirect leaven, there will not be that leaven in free societies like our own, which we absolutely have to have. And I can tell you from my experience writing this book, The Catholic Martyrs of the 20th Century, that the most striking thing to me of all was how ordinary most 20th century martyrs were. Now, you know, you get a great figure like Maximilian Kolbe. He would have been a great saint if he had never died in Auschwitz. You get a great woman like Edith Stein, Sister Benedicta of the, Teresa Benedicta of the Cross. She would have been a great figure if she had not died in Auschwitz. But most of the people who were called upon to be martyrs were ordinary people, lots of them lay people, who every day just sort of, you know, developed the normal virtues that our tradition tells us we have to develop. You know, we have to be truthful, we have to be honest, we have to be courageous when wrong things are being done around us, we have to stand up for people who are being subjected to injustice. And those people who were up to that point were otherwise absolutely ordinary. When they were put in extraordinary circumstances, became extraordinary themselves, over and over and over again. Someone asked me after I wrote that book, weren't you depressed to be looking at all these people who were killed in the 20th century? And I have to tell you, the thought had never crossed my mind in the year I wrote that book. I said to this person who asked me, I've never spent more time with such great people. You know, just wonderful people who engaged whatever challenge that they were called upon. To engage. So I hope, and I'm reasonably confident, that we won't face that kind of persecution in the United States in our lifetimes. But there's much else that needs doing that isn't necessarily as visible or as terrible as martyrdom. And we need to think on that. We need to think on it because the world is always being, you know, is always drifting away. The usual temptations of, you know, power, money, sex, drugs, alcohol, you know, et cetera, are always there with us. Lent is the time that we free ourselves personally. You know, we try to refrain ourselves personally from those things. And for what? You know, partly, yes, to be with God because we've led a good life. But that's not all. You have to be willing to go out and love people around you. I'll leave you with this thought from Dostoevsky. I don't know if you know the Russian novelist Dostoevsky, but His book, The Brothers Karamazov, is a beautiful, great, wonderful book. And there's a holy Russian Orthodox priest, Father Zosima, in it. And this woman comes to him, who's just in utter despair about her faith. You know, she's lost her faith. She doesn't know how to find it again. She wants him to give her arguments about how to find her faith and how do I, you know. And he's a wise old priest, and he says to her, look, try to love God and try to love people around you every day. And do this more and more. And you'll see this way has been tried and this way has been proven. It's that way of holiness that will hold our identities as Catholics together and count on it. It will transform not only your families, not only your community. It can transform America and it can transform the world. That's why Jesus came into the world and asked his disciples to preach the gospel to all nations. There are 1.5 billion Christians in the world today after 12 relatively unknown Jews and a small Roman province started this little movement. Who knows where it can be tomorrow? I was a lover of John Paul, and I always used to just balk at one thing he said. I never thought the Soviet Union would fall, and he thought it would. But you recall, he always used to say, be not afraid, and this is just the beginning of the springtime of the church. And given the great holiness and the great intelligence that he brought to his own life in our time, I wouldn't bet against him, and I think we ought to follow him. So thank you, and I'll welcome your questions or comments.
Thank you very much, Dr. Royal. You said about the importance of listening in prayer, that usually when you stop talking, your prayers are answered. Usually when I stop talking, that means that their prayers are answered. We'll be happy to take some questions. We always promise you we're out here by 8:30. And I came up to repeat the questions because this is being recorded, so for the sake of the recording. Does anybody have a question? Yes, please stand.
Well, first of all, as a professor of philosophy and Atonism and Dr. Wallen, thank you for your advocacy. My question is, we sort of an interesting political time insofar as in the next presidential race, the standard pro-life issues that define, you know, sort of the capital vote in recent political history are sort of off the table in the sense that we have candidates who are, at best, lukewarm on the issues. And so I'm curious, you're not sold by the term Washington insider. I'm curious what you think might be some of the other issues, in addition to the standard polarized issues we care about, that might help define the Catholic vote as we enter into the next later this year.
That's a long question. Translation, Dr. Royal, is most of the candidates for political office now are idiots. And the pro-life issues are not big issues to many of them. What are some other issues that you think will be factors or should be factors in this election?
Well, it's true that this is going to be a season of modest pro-life debate. John McCain is pro-life, and the people who are around him advising him about these issues are all very solid. So, you know, in the way that Washington tends to work, maybe this is a little extreme of a way to put it, but it's still really basically like an old feudal system. Now, you guys have that, you guys have Burgundy, and you guys have, Provence, and the people who are engaged with McCain right now will be solid, mostly Catholic people on these issues. So they will hold the line. Well, whether they will move the ball any, should he be elected, I don't know. Democrats obviously will not touch pro-life policies. I don't think that the debate is going to be particularly strong during this campaign season, unfortunately. But you know, you don't win every season. You have to kind of keep hope alive, even when things look pretty bleak. I meant to tell you, the last time I was in Indiana was back on November 3rd, and I saw Notre Dame play Navy and lose in triple overtime. This is a much happier occasion for this. I mean, if we can keep hope alive with the Notre Dame football season we just had, maybe even pro-life stuff will survive this campaign. It's unfortunate, but it's not going to be a strong season. Yes?
I found it interesting that you equated abortion and some of the horrible Holocaust that have occurred, and the whole idea of Catholics having been traditional Democrats, and many of them still vote Democratic. My question is, to what do you attribute the culturalization of Catholicism, i.e. we have Edward Kennedy, we have Biden, we have Dodd, who quote-unquote represent Catholics, and yet my guess is that from a value standpoint, they are absolutely diametrically opposed to many of the Catholic values. So to summarize, not as succinctly as Father Shadle does, but to what do you attribute the culturalization of Catholicism? It's not religious, it's cultural, more like the traditional Jews, which some are religious, and many of them look at themselves as cultural Jews.
That's a long question. Translation is, we have a lot of idiot politicians who call themselves Catholic but really aren't. Why? What do you attribute the culturalization of Catholicism to? That's a good question, really.
Well, it is a very complex question, and it's a very sore point, obviously. I grew up in a ethnic Catholic working class parish, and I don't think I met a Republican until I was at least in high school. Not a known Republican, at least in high school. So I know who these people are, who tend to vote still for it. The church has a great history of being close to labor, being close to immigrant groups, and a lot of that just transferred over, even as the Democratic Party, unfortunately, became very monolithic, virtually monolithic, because you do get a few standouts. Robert Casey, governor of Pennsylvania, was a notable one. But unfortunately, I think I don't want to speak blanketly about every one of these people, but they found rationalizations for why they're going to do what they think is going to help them politically. This is not. I'm ashamed about the joke I'm about to tell you. It's said of Teddy Kennedy that his Catholicism is so private that he doesn't even impose it on himself. Just about everywhere I speak about this sort of public dimension of Catholicism, somebody asks this question. And I don't know, I don't know how to answer it other than if we do continue, as we have been, making inroads in public opinion about pro-life issues. You've probably read these stories where the daughters are actually more pro-life than the mothers in certain families. A slow growth in pro-life opinion in the country. If it gets to the point that, you can win elections by being pro-life, Henry Hyde used to say, I heard him say this more than once, that in almost all districts in the United States, to be pro-life is sort of a 6% net gain, because people who were adamantly, abortion for any reason, and adamantly, no abortion, except for very extreme rare cases. If you combine those two, you get a 6% pro-life hangover. But most politicians don't want to do it. And certainly in the Democratic Party, it's become virtually impossible. When Governor Casey, who was a very courageous man, wanted to speak at the Democratic convention in, when was it, 92? No one let him speak. He had to go across the street and have his own rally. So you get ostracized, and it's not good for the Democratic Party. I could imagine myself occasionally voting for a Democrat, but I can't. For me, the pro-life question is a deal breaker, because nobody can cooperate in the direct taking of innocent human life. Now, our bishops have spoken up. If you haven't read the bishop's statement on faithful citizenship, they do it every couple of years. They just brought it out a little while ago. It's very good. It's not because of certain political factions within the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops, the language isn't always as clear as it ought to be. But I'm going to tell you, as Father, what it really says. What it really says, and these words are in there, not all moral issues are on the same plane. And, look, we're all in favor of finding ways to help people who are poor, who are marginalized, who are discriminated against. We're all opposed to war, except when we have to go to war. These are all issues that Catholics can agree on and can maybe disagree about the practical questions of, how we go about doing those things. Some people think you need a higher minimum wage. Some people think if you abolish the minimum wage, you get more jobs. These are policy questions. These are rational attempts to analyze things that you can't know about ahead of time. But on these questions of what are called intrinsic evils, euthanasia, abortion, destroying embryos for stem cell research, etc. These are the destruction of innocent human life. So they're always wrong. Now, you can debate what tactics will help lower, you know, the legal presence of these awful practices in our society, but you have to be opposed to them. And it's one thing, you know, people used to say about Governor Cuomo, who was a very eloquent man and a very good politician, former governor of New York, and a Catholic, and a kind of a self-proclaimed, you know, proud Catholic. He used to say about the death penalty that, you know, the Vatican has said we really shouldn't be using the death penalty anymore. There are alternatives to protect society. You know, it's debatable whether that's true or not. And he used to work very vigorously in the New York State Legislature to restrict the death penalty. When it came to abortion, he just said, well, you know, I can't impose this on the rest of society. Well, you know, it's not like he issues a fiat and then everybody has to do what he says. I mean, you have to go through the political process. And, you know, one of the things I often tell people is, if we're told that you can't say that and you can't, you know, vote that because that's a Catholic position, I say, so what? You know, if I'm dumb enough to vote on it, you know, because I'm a Catholic, well, I mean, people vote for all sorts of idiotic crazes. I think they're right to vote on their own. And this particular issue is not a Catholic issue. Now, as I said earlier, this is a natural law question. You can't attack innocent life. For the moment that embryo is conceived, it's got a unique DNA. It's male or female. By the time anybody knows, by the time any woman knows she's pregnant, that child has a heartbeat and has detectable brainwave activity. Well, it's a living being with a unique human DNA. I don't know what else you call it other than a human being. And as Ronald Reagan used to say, and he wasn't a political philosopher or much of a philosopher, but he used to say, look, if you find a guy in the gutter and you think he's dead, you don't just start throwing dirt on him. You try to help him first. You know, you don't just throw him away. So there always has to be a presumption in favor of life. Now, this argument is making headway. I think little by little it's making headway because people see how awful the alternative is. But it's still going to remain a struggle. And we cannot give up, can't give up one iota on this because there are so many forces arrayed around the world to push this everywhere you turn. One of the groups that I work with is a Catholic group located at the UN. And they're constantly, I'm on the board of this group, they're constantly, and Dr. Geisler, who's here and lives here in Indianapolis, I guess, is on the board of the Culture of Life Foundation with me, which is a different, slightly different group. We find everywhere there are international elites trying to push abortion. You know, there's been a effort recently to try to rewrite the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the UN. And what's going to happen is people are going to try to include rights to abortion and gay marriage. The original Universal Declaration was written by Jacques Maritain, mostly by Jacques Maritain, the French Catholic philosopher, great French Catholic philosopher. So, you know, everywhere that this stuff pops up, you see that there are these, you know, people are rushing in, and you have to stay right on top of it. Kosovo, I'm sure most of you haven't been exactly spending most of your time thinking about Kosovo lately, but Kosovo recently declared itself independent over the weekend, last weekend. Kosovo is mostly a Muslim state, and it's a disaster, and it's got to be run by Europeans. The economy and the politics have to be run by Europeans. So it's a Muslim state, and I started to see when they declared themselves independent, certain people popping up and saying, oh no, now we've got a member of Europe who's going to be Islamic and, you know, the whole problem of jihadism and Sharia law and whatnot. The Kosovo Constitution was written by European Union experts, and it has a right to abortion and a right to homosexual marriage. This little Muslim, you know, strip out there in the Balkans had this constitution imposed on it. So the struggle is everywhere. You know, the cultural struggle here is one that you have to keep your eyes open constantly. Right? You know, we all get burned out when we have to kind of keep pushing things back. But we cannot grow weary with this. I mean, take a vacation if you have to, but come back swinging hard because it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. And unfortunately, our Catholic politicians, for the most part, have not been helping.
Okay, Gunther, thank you very much. And as time goes on, these political questions are going to be very much in the forefront and very much something that we need to think about. Think about it very carefully. For example, I was talking with one of our parishioners, this is you, Jerry, that had talked to a local candidate, and he was very disappointed, and I was too, because this local candidate had a lot of right views, but he was not going to vote for the amendment to ban gay marriage. He wasn't going to vote that. But I saw an interview with him in the Star the other day, and they asked him about it. You know what he said? He said, I'm not going to vote for it because religious is marriage is a moral religious issue, and the government has no business legislating it, which I thought was a very, very interesting response on his part. So you have to be careful in making your judgments, very careful. It's 8:33. You know where your children are. Again, thank you for coming. There's a couple things, all the things that are available there at the tables up there to my left. A reminder, let's see, next week we have Moira Noonan, who used to be a New Age religion practitioner.